is the Disaster Recovery Hour. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
Good afternoon, Disaster Recovery Hour. I am your host, Chris Plunkett. Every Tuesday between 1 and 2 p.m., WVNJ 1160, The Voice. We got a lot of stuff we're going to be covering today, so we're going to go in pretty quickly. I just want two things. Patrick, hope you feel better. That's my son. He's home from school today. Second, from the lieutenant from last week's show, we talked about fire prevention, smokes, and carbon monoxides. And front page today in the Record, Bergen Record, is a family almost dies, unfortunately, because of carbon monoxide. So it's a never-ending intel that needs to be out there every time. The show does a lot of repeating. I do a lot of repeating. I do a lot of broken record, if you will. But carbon monoxides and smokes, they save lives. These guys see it every single day. And that leads me into my first guest, who's already on the line for me. It is Battalion Chief, 2nd Battalion Chief, FDNY, downtown on Houston, and I think it's 7th or 9th. I got Chief Salamillo on the line. Chief, how you doing?
Yes, very good, Chris. How are you?
Good. Is it 7th or is it 9th, Ave?
It's actually 6th Avenue West House.
Jesus, I'm wrong. God, it's a big house on the end of house, and you can't miss it. It's right at the end of the house and street. Chief, we have a mutual friend, Andy Weisberg, who's the ACP chapter president in Long Island Association of Contingency Planners. And last week, he gave me some information about the partnering to prevent tragedy, and this is FDNY and Mount Sinai are partnering to. That's a conference that is next week, and it is about collaborating, because my understanding from 03 to 2010 there was 28 incidents at hospitals around the city, and that's an enormous amount of numbers, and this is the second year you guys are getting together.
Right, actually 2800.
2800. I said 28,000?
No, you said 28, sorry.
Oh, okay. No, please correct me. You know what? I got to put my glasses on. But that's what happens when you get 46 years old. 2800 incidents. I thought this was important. I'm glad you were able to take some time, because I know you are at the station and you're working. But tell me a little bit about how this arose, and you know, because a lot of people don't see the behind the scenes that you guys do in the city, out on the island, here in Jersey. There's a lot of training that doesn't make the papers, right. You know. And that's why I like, you know, when yourself and like last week, Lieutenant came on and some other guys come on and we get the information out. And I think it's important for people to know about it.
So I agree. Thank you, Chris.
So give me a little history on that.
Well, this is our second annual hospital fire safety conference, Partnering to Prevent Tragedy. We started this a year ago after doing some research and experiencing some significant fires in New York City, one of which was in Mount Sinai in 07. And looking into the fire code and the building code and how we operate at hospitals and what regulations they have to work on, we realize that there is a lot of there's a lack of uniformity when it comes to hospitals. A lot of hospitals can operate very differently than others, and we felt that with the events that have gone on, that it really warrants us getting together and trying to promote an environment where people can go to hospitals and be safe.
Right. I mean, it's the whole, you know, you go into a hospital because there's an incident on the outside and you want to get better, you know, to break it down in real simple terms. It's taken some years that you and I were talking about it before to get a collaboration going on, and you have some fantastic people for next week's conference. You have your fire commissioner and numerous other keynote speakers, which I'm sure you can rattle off if you like. And
the lineup is pretty. It's a pretty good one, if I must say. We are bringing in people from Joplin to talk about the Joplin tornado. When that happened, a hospital actually got destroyed. There were some significant injuries, and we're going to talk about that. And we're also going to talk about how New York City prepared for the most recent hurricane and compare the two to see how they react when something is so quick to occur and when we have time to prepare to occur. When we have time to prepare for an incident. And then we also will be talking about, again, stemming from last year's conference, we developed some what we feel are best practices, what we feel hospitals can employ to make their institutions safer. And we also have a representative from London coming because last year they experienced, 2 years ago, they experienced 5 significant hospital fires in a year. So we've worked together to see the similarities and differences and the roadblocks that are encountered when you try and institute change. And that's one of the biggest things, is trying to get hospitals to be a little proactive as opposed to waiting for us to change building codes and fire codes and have the Joint Commission, so the NFPA, change their regulations.
It takes time. And you talk about London, and you talk about the city, those are, there's old buildings. And then, the hospitals are expanding, some of the good hospitals, but more the ones that make money, I guess, right?
Right, well, the bigger ones.
The bigger ones, right. So they're adding new construction onto old construction. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that you're seeing and say, I'm sure there's a fine line, but you got to hit a little time out here and say, listen, I think we need to start looking at something here because it's not right.
No, and it could definitely be, you could definitely make them safer, from a first responder perspective, there's things that can be done to make our jobs easier, provide us with more, information, accurate information and useful information so we can deal with the fire or emergency that we're responding to.
So, now the hospital personnel, is it a mindset, or
I think it's twofold. One, they've been doing it for such a long time that this is what they're used to. But two, it's people aren't quick to change.
Right.
For instance, from one of the things that we look for when we respond is for a knowledgeable person to meet the first responders when we respond to give us information, let us know what the alarm is for. Now, that person is identified, in the hospital's emergency action plan, but, from the fire department's perspective, what training do they have?
Right.
In New York City, in high-rise office commercial buildings, New York City requires high-rise buildings to have fire safety directors. They are certified through the fire department, knowledgeable in their building systems, and are very useful if there is an emergency or fire at that building. That is not required in hospitals today.
And wow.
Yeah, that was definitely an eye-opener, especially you don't know who you're going to get when you respond. There could be some hospitals do have fire safety directors, others a building engineer will come and meet you, others the security guard, and unfortunately, sometimes no one meets you.
Wow. That's that's eye opening, and for people, that's why, having this conference, and I thought, wow, this is, when I read it last week, and Andy gave me the information, I'm like, well, that's I had been one in Jersey. It was more of a triage with Mass over here at a Holy Name. A retired lieutenant from State Police, Jim Brucati, was the head of it, but they were talking about the casualties and coming in and in case that the building wasn't couldn't be occupied, and they had temporary triage areas and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that, which was really interesting. Again, these are the things that the public doesn't know about that's taking place. So you go into the hospitals and you're like I said, you put a time out, and they think they're doing it right, but you being the first responder and heck, a battalion chief on top, you've seen enough to warrant that distinction. So you're like, you got to change your thought pattern here.
Well, we're hoping to do that, and in part of the conference, we're hoping to educate the attendees and what can be done. And there are some no cost items that provide a lot of benefit. In addition, we're also going to be talking about MRI safety. Unfortunately, there's been incidents in the past, injuries and fatalities as they deal with MRIs, and also, surgical room fires. That's been on the rise also.
Wow. It takes a fatality to make change from your...
Unfortunately, society is very reactionary. Very rarely are we proactive, and history has shown that it takes a tragedy to occur before we invoke any change. And we're trying to, New York City Fire Department with Mount Sinai is trying to be proactive, trying to recommend certain changes that could be made to make hospital institutions safer. And we're hoping that people take that, you know, that's something that they take away from this conference.
Yeah. If you just joined us at Disaster Recovery Hour, if you want to put out a comment for the chief, feel free. It's drhradio.net. That is drhradio.net. One more time, it's drhradio.net. You can ask the chief whatever you like to ask. We're going to go to a break in a couple of seconds. So, Chief, when we come back, let's I know investigating and going to these incidents, and you say, you know, a fire at Mount Sinai, we got to do things different. But there's it goes back a long ways of city codes and things like that. And you said the last upgrade, there was one in 1968, and you said what, 1976 or something? Or?
Well, the past two building codes were, one just came out in 2008, which made some changes to how new hospitals are built. The one before that goes back to 1968, so that one was 40 years old. But you know, there aren't too many new hospitals going out and being built, and you know, that's one of the big things.
That's a challenge, right?
You know, that you have older buildings out there that aren't as safe as they could possibly be.
Yeah. We'll go to a break. Pick it back up with the chief in just a second.
If you missed part of today's program or you want to hear the show again, you can do so with the Disaster Recovery Hour podcast. Just go to www.drhradio.net, enter your email address, and the show will be delivered to your inbox. Keep you and your family safe by getting information on being prepared with the Disaster Recovery Hour podcast, available at drhradio.net. When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need action fast. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP will find the visible and hidden damage caused by a fire or flood. With quick response and correctly applied damage mitigation protocols, ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP can save you valuable time and money and get you back in the game of life. Anytime disaster strikes, quick, focused action is what can save your property. CPP's professional staff is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. To reach ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's cppems.com, cppems.com. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP, servicing the New York metro and tri-state area.
Do you know that there are some emergency shelters that have no emergency backup generators? You can be prepared and have your own emergency generator for your home and business. Hi, I'm Dan O'Brien from Academy Electrical Contractors Incorporated, a full-service electrical contractor servicing the tri-state area since 1981. Our specialty is generators. We give you a complete turnkey installation, service your existing generator, rent you the temporary machine for that planned shutdown or that unexpected power failure. Academy Electrical Contractors can install a generator to protect your family and business from a power grid failure. Power your heating and air conditioning system, keep your refrigerator and freezer running, power your well pump, or power your sump pump. Visit us on the web at academyelectrical.com. That's academyelectrical.com. Or give me a call at 877-SPARKIES. That's 877-772-7597. Academy Electrical Contractors, generating satisfaction 24/7 since 1981.
Sergeant Jason Nielsen was paralyzed while serving as an MP in Iraq.
The sniper from down the alleyway shot me. 6 weeks later, I woke up at Walter Reed, not really knowing where I was at.
Paralyzed veterans of America's National Service officers, such as Sherita Latham, are trained to help injured veterans get all the benefits they've earned.
I could call Sherita at 11 o'clock at night and she would answer the phone and be like, "What can I do for you, Jason?"
If someone needs you, you listen to them. If they call, we're there for them.
She worked with my wife hand in hand, took care of everything for me just so I could focus on just recovery and trying to get on with life.
If there was no PVA, we wouldn't have the benefits that we have. We wouldn't know about the benefits.
To learn how you can help paralyzed veterans, visit PVA.org.
Welcome back to Disaster Recovery Hour. On the phone today with me, calling in from from a station house in the city is Battalion Chief Phil Salamillo. Chief, we're talking about partnering to prevent tragedy and with Mountain partnering up with Mount Sinai. But you know, all the years you've been on the job, there's been with the building codes. Let me back up just for a second. I have a question for you from a web question from this guy, from a person, George. George, is there anything in local governments that make this training mandatory? And if not, why not? And what arm of the government controls this? So I guess it's the fire marshals or the people on the individual floors, or is there a contingency plan that people have to do this?
Well, there is training. The hospitals have to have a certain level of training to deal with emergencies. I mean, each hospital has an emergency action plan, which designates certain people to have responsibilities in case an emergency does occur, emergency/fire. And from executive staff to the nurses to the doctors, everyone's got a role, and that's pretty well specified. But in regard to training through the fire department or certain certifications with the fire department, that's not required at this time. I mean, hospitals are required, I believe, through the Joint Commissions or the NFPA, that they have to have a relationship with the fire department and drill with them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't occur, or it doesn't occur as often as it should. I mean, through the past couple of years, I mean, New York City Fire Department has established relationships with, Mount Sinai, Beth Israel, North Shore, LIJ, where we are training with them and doing drills and tabletop exercises. So, we are establishing better relationships with our local area hospitals.
Yeah, I was, I do a fair amount of work in New York City, and obviously with the between flooding and fires, it's a pretty active business. But I notice when I get to meet the building engineer, whether it's a res or a commercial space, they generally have a certification that they've gone through some training through your department,
right?
And that, which is another thing, I asked these guys, some of the buildings don't even realize that these guys are doing that on their off time, getting this training. They all take their houses, or I should say their buildings, like it's theirs, and it's there, they run the show. But it's nice to see that again, that's a proactive side.
It is a proactive, but it's a valuable asset to the fire department, to the responders, the first responders, to actually go and be greeted by a person who's knowledgeable in their building systems and their, everything that has to deal with their building, because there are so many different types of buildings out there.
Right.
It's virtually impossible for firefighters to know everything about the building, and that's why you want those subject matter experts, your building engineers, your fire safety directors there, because they're there to help you. And help you deal with the emergency, and they're really valuable people,
right? because we call it what it is. I mean, you guys are going into an apartment building, and does anyone know that they divided the apartment up to three apartments? And obviously, I'm not going to tell you your business, but
hospitals are hospitals are very unique. They have hazardous materials, they have biologicals, they have medical gases. There are so many hazards that exist in hospitals, and not having a required knowledgeable certified person to meet you is just one of the suggestions that we have.
Now, one of the persons you'll be partnering up is the head of emergency preparedness at a London hospital, Andy Wappling, I think, isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, have you gone over there, or has he been?
No, I have not traveled to London, but Andy was a part of our last year's conference, and he really shed a lot of light on the issues and what they experienced over there, and the recommendations that they made after their fires somewhat coincided with our recommendations. Andy is coming back this year, and one of the major changes or that that they made is, you know, over the past year, London unfortunately experienced a fatal fire in a hospital, and as a result of that, now London is requiring their hospitals to be sprinklered. And that was a big eye-opener for us as we were doing our research that, again, depending upon when the building was erected, mm-hmm. You know, not all hospitals are required to be sprinkled.
That's an amazing.
It really is. And, you know, that is a cost item that we're well aware of, but you can't compare that to, you know, the value of life. And sprinklers have been shown to greatly reduce the loss of life, you know, 73%. You know, so it, again, that's one of the recommendations. And I don't believe that was, you know, London was going to do that until the fatality occurred.
Right, and they got a couple buildings that are a little older than ours too.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Unfortunately, a couple of them were destroyed as a result of the fire.
You know, I had with the World Police and Fire Games this past summer. My brother was able to befriend this firefighter from Oslo, and we had him on the show. He had went back, and it was like, I don't know what time it was in the morning when he called, but he was on shift. And I was asking him if, you know, because he was talking to the guys on FDNY. There's a lot. You know, it's a worldwide game plan, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, you think like, oh, there's, you know, what kind of country, Oslo or, you know, Pakistan or whatever, any of those foreign countries, you think like, oh, you know, we know what we're doing. But it's kind of a, not kind of, but it is pretty similar across the board.
Yes, it is. It is. And you know, just, you know, these fires in hospitals occur everywhere. I mean, there's just one, I believe, about 2 weeks ago in Australia, and a nurse is actually being charged with murder as a result of the fire.
God.
Five people died. So, you know, they are holding people accountable. So, you know, the people who work, the employees of these institutions, you know, should really take note, because you could, you know, you could be held responsible for, God forbid, a fatality in this type of establishment.
Yeah, that's. I didn't know. Bill was supposed to give me that information. I don't know why he wasn't giving me that. I'm breaking his chops right now. But, Chief, some of the other things with the partnering, are there other community partnerships that you guys do?
Well, in what regard? Regarding
yeah, you know, you have the Mount with Mount Sinai.
Well, and we are holding drills right now. They are preparing drills with Beth Israel. We have been creating quite a good relationship with the New York Presbyterian. So, you know, we are reaching out. The local battalions and the local companies have been establishing very positive relationships with the institutions in their response areas. And, you know, the New York City Fire Department has really taken a proactive approach in that regard.
Yeah.
Because you really can't stress the value of a relationship to be able to know the person that you're dealing with when you respond there, and you already have a relationship established, as opposed to seeing a person for the first time.
Yeah, I don't think it gets enough credit, you know, relationships. You know, business is business, but, you know, a relationship, we can solidify that. That's how I look at it. You don't want to go in a foxhole with a guy, you know, or a woman, whichever.
Right.
But, I, you know, being up at Presbyterian, my wife had a procedure, my lovely wife, that is,
mm-hmm.
and she had a procedure last January, and, you know, that's an old hospital, but then they had the new wings, and
right.
it's morphed into this monster up there.
Yes, and those are the... Those are the institutions that, you know, they're very complex when they're you know, intertwined with old and new, and you have different. One was built at one time, and how do their systems talk to each other? And but, you know, like a Columbia Presbyterian, you know, they really have some valuable people up there that bring a lot to the table and make our life a lot easier when we have to respond there.
Yeah, I mean, we got lost. You know, because it's, and then you know, go down there, take a left, and you know, my wife is nervous as get out, which rightfully so, she had a procedure done, but
right.
It is a.
Imagine doing that in the spoke condition.
Yeah, exactly. So having that relationship is key. The website, Chief. What's the website?
The website is www.fdnyfoundation.com. That has all the information on the conference next week, December 8th and 9th. 2-day conference at the New York Sheraton. It's going to be very informational, and you know, you can actually register at the door, and we welcome anyone. If you have any questions, I can give you the phone number.
Yeah, go for it.
That's 718-999-0779.
Yeah, it's also on the DRH website, people, if you want to check it out. It's been up there for a week and change since Andy, my good friend Andy Weisberg, gave me the info. I mean, you got some... Got some major heavy hitters. I mean, you're a heavy hitter, and you got the guy from, you know, Andy from London. You got Brian Williams, the news anchor guy, and obviously your commissioner. That's and the Joplin thing is that's going to be a good hour and change talking about that experience, because you know, I mean, you and I can roll, because I want you to come back on again and talk about some other things that you and I spoke about last night.
Mm-hmm.
The website's up on the web is up on our website. If you guys want to attend, you want to get some information about it, it's out there. Hey, Chief, I really appreciate you taking time today.
Thank you, Chris, and let me know if you want to come.
I have to go. I'm going to Tennessee next week for a week to this Disaster Academy down there for some training. And but I'm going to shoot. I'm going to swing by your house in the week after that. Get a little face to face time with you.
That sounds great. Anytime.
Thanks, Chief. Appreciate it. Take care.
First cup of coffee's on me.
All right, thanks, bro. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Let's go to a break, and that was very informative from the chief. We'll go to break, pay some bills, and come back with the next guest. Thanks.
When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need answers. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP is the answer. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP is a full-service emergency services and restoration company. With 25 years of experience in emergency management and restoration, our seasoned team of skilled professionals is ready to assess damages and restore your property to its pre-loss condition.
Who do I call first? What about insurance? Is it safe to stay here? What do I do next?
Fire, smoke, water, or mold, ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP restores your property and your peace of mind. To reach ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's cppems.com, cppems.com. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP, servicing the New York Metro and Tri-State area.
Valentine's UFO show, watching strange visitors that come and go. The UFO show at Cape Valentine. We're gonna travel through space and rocket through time, exploring what is possible, examining what is logical. Could we really be here all alone?
Are we really out here alone? Find out on the UFO show with Kate Valentine, Friday afternoons at 1 on WVNJ.
Sally Field for Wounded Warrior Project.
There are so many things that we take for granted in our lives, but one thing that we should never take for granted are the brave men and women of our volunteered armed forces who daily risk their lives for our freedom. Some of these brave warriors have suffered catastrophic injuries. Some will suffer the effects of traumatic brain injury for the rest of their lives. The Wounded Warrior Project was created to help and support these injured heroes. Regardless of your position on the war, they deserve our help. Please consider the many ways that you can get involved. The Wounded Warrior Project's motto is, "The greatest casualty is being forgotten." Let's continue to help make this generation the most well-received group of injured veterans in our nation's history. We owe it to them. To learn more, call 877-832-6997 or visit woundedwarriorproject.org.
We're back, Disaster Recovery Hour. Your host, Chris Plunkett, every Tuesday between 1 and 2 p.m., WVNJ, 1160 AM, The Voice. Thanks again, Chief. I appreciate you taking some time. I know you're working. I have another fabulous guest on the line. Shelly, you there?
I am. Hi,
hey,
Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Shelly? Shelly Lee Johnson. Shelly is a public relations director for the ACP of New York City chapter. She's been in the contingency planning business for over 20 years, multiple hats. Shelly does so many things, we need three shows for Shelly. But we're going to focus today, because you are in the public sector and you are an employee for FEMA's Disaster Workforce Division. You were hired, deployed, starting with Katrina, and you and I were talking about it numerous different times about, you know, we have Irene, and lessons learned, because, you know, unfortunately, people just like to point the fingers. You know, everyone wants a point for blame. You know, no one, I don't know, that's the way I always look at it. You know, it's just easy to point blame and not do anything and mouth off and so on and so forth. But, you know, you made some good points, you know, with our previous conversations. You know, you are boots on the ground. You're, you know, like myself, you know, after the first responders, the heroes leave, and including yourself with FEMA, you know, I come in and I assess damage, and, you know, I'm so-called boots on the ground also, if you will, so I can speak from experience. And you're not just an administrator of that end. I mean, you've seen it on the FEMA disaster.
Yeah, I'm out there in the field walking through the debris water up to my knees, right along with you, Chris, and we're certainly thrilled to see, you know, the contractors come in like yourself and start helping these traumatized victims of disaster start putting their lives back together.
Yeah, it's there's a job to be done, but it's not the, you know, give me the regular stuff, you know, when people are masses, you know, neighborhoods just wiped out. It's a kind of a bad feeling that you have a job to do. I understand that. I'm not being naive about this, but there is a sadness to it.
There certainly is. And just to go back on one of your earlier comments, one of my personal passions is to get the individual citizens more prepared to take care of their own family and household and expand that to the other people that live on their block. They may not interact with them regularly,
right,
and so they don't know actually who lives three houses down from them. It might be a 90-year-old single widow. You know, there's, to be fair to folks, it is a traumatic situation when you've seen everything that's familiar with you damaged, destroyed, if you don't know exactly how long it's going to take to recover, especially when you're right in the middle of the event itself. Take Hurricane Irene, for example. When folks are traumatized and they're frightened or they're feeling guilty that they didn't prepare, that they didn't get insurance, that they didn't tie down the shed, a whole list of shoulda, woulda, couldas.
Mm-hmm, right.
It is only natural that fear drives them to want to deflect temporarily the responsibility for that blame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fear, frustration, an inability to know exactly what steps to take next. And that's why we are there with boots on the ground to help people not only stay safe through the event, but also to recover as quickly as possible and get back to being whole individuals and be able to carry on with their lives.
Right. Well, you know, it was, you know, Shelly put me in contact with an older woman down in Edison, and there's a perfect example of, you know, that the older person, you know, can't really fend for themselves alone, is because she's very old. I'm not going to name names, but she's a spunky little gal, isn't she, though? She is,
yeah,
a spunky girl. But, you know, leaving her house the way it was. You know, when I came in and I said, you know, thank God you said get out of the house, because people don't get it that you know, it's their fear factor. We did a show.
We see that happen a lot with younger families, folks that you would kind of expect to be savvy to the health risk. But again, that's part of the denial process, part of the grief and denial process. You know, if you have a home and you have some kids and they need to go to school nearby, and sometimes the power of positive thinking can get in the way of actually mitigating health issues and additional subsequent damage from the event. Let me just go back for a second and explain that as a member of the FEMA Disaster Reserve workforce, I have been deployed to a number of disasters, but we work as full-time intermittent employees of Department of Homeland Security. When we're not deployed, we're not on payroll and not in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But we stand ready, packed and ready to go within a 24 to 72 hours of an event and a call out. And we stand ready to go anywhere in the United States, its territories or protectorates, and ready to assist victims of disasters. But we can only be there at the request of tribal, local, county, state officials. Those officials start looking at incoming threats. They have to do a damage assessment, mm-hmm. of a preliminary damages assessment of how severely their areas are going to be affected. The governor has to request a presidential declaration, and then the Stafford Act gets activated, and FEMA can put their boots on the ground. That's when the feds show up and, mm-hmm. and can start helping those victims of disaster. But we still remain there, and all the local authorities are in charge. We operate within their guidelines.
I don't think people knew that. You know, they just assume, you know, for example, I mean, and you would talk about personally with your relationship, as you have a perfect partner with that who's okay with you just getting on a plane and rolling to a disaster.
That makes a big difference.
Yeah.
You know, your family has to be willing to say, see you whenever.
Right.
When I left for, you know, my first call out was Hurricane Irene, and I found my way to New Orleans by way of the Coast Guard Auxiliary. That was such a horrific event and so widespread, and in 2005, most people might remember that there were mudslides and fires in California, there was flooding in the Midwest, there were events and catastrophes all over before the 1st of September. And so all of the existing FEMA disaster assistance employees were deployed.
No one else
was available.
Right. Yeah,
so
no.
We called on the sister agency, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, where we have, there are, I don't know whether people know this, but there are as many volunteer Coast Guard auxiliaries as there are enlisted Coast Guard.
Wow.
So there were a lot of us, and because the Coast Guard is a sister agency to FEMA, it was only natural that they reach out to us and see who was willing to head down to New Orleans,
right.
and the Gulf Coast to help with that response. And as it turned out, most of the Coast Guard stations were destroyed, and they converted us over to FEMA disaster assistance employees. And
away you went.
I've been a storm chaser ever since.
Disaster Recovery Hour, if you just join us on the phone right now, before I had the chief, and now I have, who's a chief in her own right, it's Shelley Lee Johnson. Shelley wears many hats, as I said. One of the large hats she wears is an employee of FEMA's disaster workforce, boots on the ground, if you will. You know, you're seeing both sides. You see the business side of it because you're part of the ACP of New York City, Metro New York City, and then the residential side. And this year, you know, on record, this is the most costly year in the history of insurance claims. It's, you know, with all the disasters that we had with tornadoes and the hurricane and the ice storms at the beginning of last year. It's so you haven't been around a lot, because I remember when we talked in Philadelphia, what, about a month ago was that?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when are you coming on the show? You're like, well, I got this, I got that. You know, so you're rocking and rolling. And like I said, we have a couple of shows we're going to do with you because you're part of CERT. We want to talk about that. We also want to talk about the serving 16 years in the Coast Guard Auxiliary. It's like, you know, there's just I think you should run the Homeland Security with this resume.
Oh, there's many of us that, like yourself, Chris, that wear a lot of hats, but they're all under the big umbrella of disaster preparedness and disaster response.
Well, I have a question from Bernie. It says, have you found the recession adding to people being less prepared because they can't afford it, less insurance, less home maintenance, etc.? Is there any assistance in place to help people with these issues? What do you think, Joe?
That's too big of a question for me to answer with authority, but I will just tell you from my experience that yes, you know, when we're out in the field, I have to say that we have seen that people let their insurance go. When the paycheck stops and people are just trying to hold on to their homes
right.
and barely make the mortgage, or maybe you're 6 months behind, then, yeah, the insurance is one of the things that goes.
It's a real cascading effect here.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I can, when I'm out with FEMA, I'm a community relations outreach professional, and we are the link between FEMA and the people affected by disasters. We're the first face of FEMA that people in the community see. And when one of our roles is to go out and help those people access disaster assistance. And of course, FEMA disaster assistance to individuals and households does address those financial shortfalls. There are limitations to the amount that's available. You know, those are all defined by law. But in answer to his question, yes, there is some help for folks that have been affected by a disaster. That's a whole other program, and I believe that your SBA.
Mike Peacock was on. That was a good show because you know there's a lot of stuff. I've been around. I've seen some things. You know, but he had a lot of information I had no clue about. And which helped our little girl down there in Edison, little Minaret. I can't remember her first name. And then yesterday was the last day for filing here
yes,
in Jersey.
In New Jersey.
You know, let's go to a commercial break. Pick it back up with Shelly. Pay some bills, and Shelly's going to rock and roll with me still.
Part of today's program, or you want to hear the show again, you can do so with the Disaster Recovery Hour podcast. Just go to www.drhradio.net, enter your email address, and the show will be delivered to your inbox. Keep you and your family safe by getting information on being prepared with the Disaster Recovery Hour podcast, available at drhradio.net. When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need action fast. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP will find the visible and hidden damage caused by a fire or flood. With quick response and correctly applied damage mitigation protocols, ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP can save you valuable time and money and get you back in the game of life. Anytime disaster strikes, quick, focused action is what can save your property. CPP's professional staff is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. To reach ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's cppems.com, cppems.com. ServiceMaster Restoration by CPP, servicing the New York metro and tri-state area.
For America's wounded warriors, coming home can sometimes be a battle in itself. Making the transition back to civilian life or active duty with a traumatic injury can be the challenge of a lifetime. The USO provides every American a way to support our wounded warriors and their families through every phase of their medical treatment and rehabilitation. It's how all of us, as a community, can give something back to our heroes. It's how we can say thank you and assure them that their sacrifice is recognized and appreciated by every one of us. Join us. Visit USO.org to learn how you can make a difference in the lives of our wounded warriors and their families. The USO, until everyone comes home.
At least one in four businesses affected by a disaster never reopen. Let me repeat, at least one in four businesses affected by a disaster, whether it's man-made or natural, never reopen. Yet far too many business owners put off their company's disaster.
You have 5 new messages.
Can you sign it for me, please?
Don't forget those copies for the presentation.
Disaster plan because they let too many day-to-day things get in the way.
Is that 3 p.m. going to be all right with your schedule?
Hey, don't forget that Stan proposes due.
Be in the conference room in 5 minutes, please.
To save your messages, press 1.
Received dispatch, truck 47 en route to 614 North Front Street.
Received. Be advised, truck 47, heavy fire showing from the 9th floor, second alarm being dispatched at this time.
Disasters are unpredictable, but when you have a plan in place, you can better adapt, recover, and stay in control. So don't wait. Visit ready.gov to make your company's disaster plan. Ready.gov. It's never too late to protect your business until it is. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, Disaster Recovery Hour. One of my guests today, my second guest, is Shelley Lee Johnson. Shelley works for FEMA. She's on the Disaster Workforce Division of that, boots on the ground. Also, with we're going to talk CERT on the next show, and also some with the Coast Guard on a following show. Shelley, one of the things we talked about was prior to the program was the lessons learned for Katrina and how it was applicable here when Irene landed.
Yes. And that was something that was really visible to me. As a resident of New Jersey for 16 years before I moved to Long Island,
ooh,
I have to tell you that I was very, very proud to see the quality of response from the government officials and the citizens themselves after Hurricane Irene and then Lee that followed, because it just didn't seem to stop raining there for about 2 months.
Right.
Having been down on the Gulf Coast, all of us saw the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Rita. I was then deployed down to Texas for Hurricane Ike for 5 months after that disaster, saw improvement in the government response there. But now here, 6 years later, the response, the pre-positioning, the organization, the response, and the lessons learned allowed officials and citizens to have a much higher survivability rate all up the East Coast, but in New Jersey in particular, the individual municipal emergency managers, many of whom are volunteers,
right,
not full-timers,
right,
and they're volunteer citizens, some of whom were CERT, some are the volunteer emergency management staff, were able to get the message out efficiently to their communities. In some cases, they went door-to-door. Those volunteers went door-to-door in their most vulnerable neighborhoods that have been known to be flood-vulnerable in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, you know, that Saturday, I think it was the 27th, and Sunday the 28th, when the height of the storm really started doing some damage and the water started rising, as soon as those waters receded enough to have some kind of local travel, you had those volunteers out again knocking on the door and telling people that FEMA was on its way and there will be help and just hang on. And it tremendous amount of community spirit, much more effective mass notification and readiness. And that's all been because of the private and public partnerships that have been developed and all of the trainings and workshops and all of the plans and protocols that have been put in place over the last 6 years since Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to really see that there were lessons learned and best practices put into place, and all we can do is hope that now the individual citizens kind of jump on that preparedness bandwagon and access some of the terrific information that's available to allow them individually to plan, prepare, to be able to respond, and then recover rapidly.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of information online. You've got FEMA volunteers. You've got the FEMA.gov. You've got Ready.gov. You've got the FEMA Emergency Management Institute website that has all kinds of free courses that are very topic-specific. And, of course, your firefighters, your police, all of your local first responders are always available to come to a school, to come to your church, to any place you want to get a group together. There is no difficulty in in finding people that'll come help you get your group or your family prepared.
Yeah, that's you know, when Governor Christie said get the hell off the beaches, I think people adhere to that, and I think it rolled downhill to local governments. You know, where I live in Bergen County, I got 7 municipalities, and I got a kind of decent feel for the communication line there, and speaking with, you know, even some of my law enforcement buddies, you know, they were doing things that, you know, that police don't do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so it was. I, you know, last week when I had the lieutenant on from the Hackensack Fire Department, you know, in 20-some-odd years of being on the job, he's never seen it that bad. And, you know, then we had the snow with the power lines and the outages and things like that, you know, so... It was so close together, but yet, you know, I'm an advocate, like we were talking about, you know, breaking it down into even a smaller, just onto the neighborhood side. You know, I'm pretty lucky. My wife and the kids, you know, we have good neighbors, and you know, we chat up a storm, you know, so it's you know, we share a few things, some information during the storms. But yeah, it was very, very evident. And then, but there's, you know, there's also the cracks. People fall through the cracks, and it's evident. You know, you talk about a mass population here.
Yeah, but I think you make a good point. One of the pitfalls is that I think people in New Jersey are over at this point after Hurricane Irene. We've never had that level of flooding. Any of us that have been in this area have known, well, it floods in Wayne, and it floods in Bound Brook, and it floods in Passaic, but it never floods all on the same weekend everywhere in the state. So folks that used to say, well, it's never done that before,
right.
I think they're over that, and I think they're starting to realize that they may be vulnerable. They could have lived in that house for 40 years, and all of a sudden their basement flooded.
Right. It was just too much. I mean, my wife and I asked what are the other measures we can... We had everything, but we still had water, and it was just... It was just too much, you know.
I heard you mention in previous programs and that you yourself have had flooding in your house multiple times over the past year. And I can say that, you know, when we get called out by FEMA, I had to say to my husband, you know, yes, Hurricane Irene is incoming. She's due here in 2 days. And yes, I'm going to... FEMA's sending me to Anniston, Alabama, and I'm going to be pre-positioned and going someplace else. So I'm glad you're all prepared and you haven't emptied out our go kit. But also, I was lucky enough to have an employer. I just want to bring this up, that my employer, Wellspring Info, a local company that prints tabbed customized guidebooks in East Rutherford, crisis guidebooks, my employer said, sure, go ahead, your job will be waiting for you when you get back, God love him. But
right.
Because he himself had undergone the same trauma, he's got a young family, and they were pumping out the basement in the middle of the winter, and, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning with a pregnant wife and son, and, you know, just, you know, people that are in these circles know that it's just really critically important work that we do, and...
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
You know, you're pumping out the basement, and then a few months later, you're living without heat and... Heating electricity for a week, and you know, you've got to be resilient. You've got to be ready to be without those conveniences. One thing that scares me is the reliance on electricity and mobile devices,
mm-hmm.
and tweeting and Twitter.
Right.
And
well, I'm going to. We've had him on the show before, John Grimendi. He's an amateur ham operator. Well, they're all amateur ham because it's not a profession. It's really a group, and there's over 600,000.
They are
operators.
Remarkable. People.
Incredible. And he's Coast Guard Auxiliary. I think you and I were talking about him at that conference. I think we're going to try to get him on next week or the following week because they're part of the, you know, the overall disaster plan when the power goes down, basically, because that's the only thing that the communication line, that's the only thing that's up and running. I do have a quick question from Gordy. It says, I don't know if you have any issues, but Shell, see if you can help Gordy. Yeah, it says, could you name the top three issues you feel that have not improved enough or that you would like to see addressed next? Are there things that can we still do things better?
Well, yes, absolutely. We can certainly do things better. I can say that my personal opinion is that the top thing that we can do better is get our citizenry more involved in the planning and preparedness process.
Yeah, I mean, open houses from the fire departments, or, you know, the social media thing is fantastic now, because people, there's apps out there. We had a person on the show talked about the preparedness app. Bill and I, we're dabbling with that ourselves here at the show. You know, but then again, you know, when I lost, you know, I lost power for a fleet a little bit of with the storm, and we only got 2 minutes to go, Shell. I told you it was going to fly. I told you. You said no. I said yes, it's going to fly. We're going to need more shows. But yeah, our reliance on power, and I lost a computer for a bit and my phone, and, you know, because everything is speed dial. You know, mm-hmm. You don't remember. Who knows? I barely know my home phone number, right? But I'm just kidding.
That's a big vulnerability. That is a big vulnerability that people forget to save their documents.
Right.
And their insurance.
Got them all in plastic.
Their phone book.
Yeah, yeah, all in plastic bags.
You know, what is my sister-in-law's number?
Right. Yeah, no, we have the old standby. It's in a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
We got a minute to go, Shell. I told you it was going to go. I told you it was going to fly. So I'll see you before our next show, obviously. But the next show, let's talk about CERT, and let's talk about your experience with the Coast Guard and on a cruise ship, not a cruise ship, but deep sea diving. You know, all these things are. You're fantastic. It's just a lot
We've
of stuff.
We've got to come up with a way to get the individual people involved. I'm sure there's some area that'll inspire your listeners to really.
And that's why we keep on pounding it. We keep on pounding it. You know.
There you go.
It's just like I said, the Bergen record today, the carbon monoxide, and we just had the lieutenant last week talking about that. Not putting blame on anybody, just the awareness. Another fantastic show. Shelly, thanks a bunch. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Okay.
All right, that's okay. Thanks, Shelly. Thanks, the chief, 2nd Battalion down in the city, down in Housen Street. Dave's giving me the 45-second look. I hope this show is informative. Smoke detectors, carbon monoxide, that stuff never goes away. So God bless our country. Bring home our troops, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.